Welcome to Let's Talk Memoir, a podcast for memoir lovers, readers, and writers. I'm your host, Ronit Plank. My guest on this episode of Let's Talk Memoir is Kate Mann, who joins me to talk about her newest book, Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia. I first became aware of Kate Mann when I read a powerful essay she wrote for the New York Times that appeared on New Year's Day a couple of years ago. And that was about fat phobia and body shame and what it's like to grow up in a culture that worships thinness. And we ended up doing an episode for my limited series called The Body Myth, and we talked about misogyny and fat phobia and the morality of size and her work in the field. And you can actually find that episode on my website when you scroll down to podcasts and look up The Body Myth, and it's one of the more recent episodes. For today's episode, we are covering her newest book, as I mentioned, and we're also going to delve into the roots of racism in anti-fatness, and we're going to talk about the psychosocial consequences of fat phobia on our bodies. Also, the shame around shame. So beyond the shame that we tackle as memoir writers, there's also the shame that we discuss in this episode about having the shame in the first place. We also are going to talk about coming of age in a fatphobic culture and what it's like to be the mother of a young child and a writer and so much more. So I know you're going to get a lot out of this episode, and I was just so happy that Kate agreed to be my guest again. It's the second time we've collaborated, and I feel so lucky that Kate was able to make the time for this show. And now a memoir moment. I had a cold I was getting over when we recorded this episode. And when I was editing this episode, I forgot that I had had this cold, and that during our recording, when Kate was explaining something that I asked her about, I had muted my microphone and was coughing. I could not get my voice back. It was just really hard to get my voice back. And I thought, what am I going to do? So I drank water while she was talking, and I took a lozenge, and I just tried to get my voice back. And then when I come back onto the mic, you'll hear my voice sounds strained, and it almost sounds like I'm getting emotional or I've been crying. And I realized when I was editing this section that I should have said something during the interview on air. I should have said, wow, my voice is kind of a mess right now. I just had a coughing fit, or I have a cold. I should have called out what was going on and been very clear about it, because anyone can hear that something's up with my voice. And I was trying to mask it and sidestep it, but it would have been probably better for the show had I mentioned that my voice was kind of a mess, and to just, you know, clear my throat a little bit and laugh about it with Kate. And I see this as a really good teaching moment, a memoir moment, because when we're working on memoir, there might be parts about our personality or parts about our behavior or parts about a situation we really don't want to talk about or we're trying to cover up or sidestep. But very often, the reader picks up on a lack of information or something that you're trying to obscure. They kind of get a sense that they're not seeing the whole picture, or that you as the memoirist are not revealing everything that you might know, or that you're not showing curiosity about something that is unclear. So my memoir moment is one that I bring to you with recognition that I missed an opportunity as a podcast memoirist, which is that I should have said something. And I hope that this example shows you what I'm talking about. And feel free to message me or find me on Instagram or Substack or on my website and let me know what you think about that. I think this is a useful example. About Substack. I have a Substack, and it's pretty new, but it is now available for you to read, as well as my newsletter on my website if you want to sign up for that. But if you love Substack, I would love to have you on my list. You can subscribe for free, and you will never miss a post about my upcoming workshops and memoir Ask Me Anythings. I'm also going to be answering questions that listeners and readers send me via message. So please subscribe to my Substack. I would love to have you there. And I will also share with you now the two upcoming offerings I have. So on May 7th, I am doing a memoir, Ask Me Anything Virtually, with Lisa Kefauver, who is the host of the beautiful podcast, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch. And we are doing this at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. It is free of charge, but you do need to register in advance. If you would like to find the link for that, you can find it on my Substack in my most recent post, or you can find it on my Instagram bio, or you can find it on my website, RoneetPlank.com. The other very exciting workshop opportunity I have coming up is a virtual retreat, an all-day virtual retreat called All About Memoir, that the host of The Shit No One Tells You About Writing, Bianca Moraes, is hosting. And on this all-day retreat, there are going to be lots of speakers, including Catherine Gildner, Chelsea Devanitz, Courtney Maum, Bonnie Reichert, Abby Maslin, and me. And each session is going to cover a different aspect of memoir writing, and it's going to be about 40 minutes of craft, and then followed by a 20-minute Q&A for people who are attending. I will be teaching the session, Putting the Plot in Your Memoir. In this session, we're going to explore the nature of plot in memoir, how to know whether you have one, tools to help eliminate the baggy parts of your manuscript, and four key elements memoirists can harness to amplify tension and stakes in their manuscripts so they crackle with resonance and momentum. I would love to see you there, and if you do register for that, please mention that I sent you. These links are all available in my Substack, in my Linktree bio in my Instagram, and also on my website, RoneetPlank.com. And there are links to all of those in the show notes of this podcast. Phew, I think we did everything. I think that's all there is to tell you for now. And there will be future workshops coming up this summer. I've already got two planned, and I will just keep rolling things out. I'll also have another memoir, Ask Me Anything, coming up over the summer. I would absolutely love to have you participate, and I'm so happy to be able to offer these memoir conversations and workshops. Now, without any further ado, on to the episode. Today, my guest is Kate Mann. She is an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University, where she's been teaching since 2013. Before that, she was a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows. Mann did her graduate work in philosophy at MIT and works in moral, social, and feminist philosophy. She is the author of three books, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, entitled How Male Privilege Hurts Women, and Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia, which came out in January. You can subscribe to her Substack newsletter, More to Hate, for musings on misogyny, fat phobia, their intersection, and more. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. And for people who may not know, you were a guest on my limited series, The Body Myth, which, you know, I had the chance to interview you about a year or so ago, maybe a little more. And our conversation was so helpful to me, and the work that you do helped me learn so much more about this culture of misogyny and fatness and how women have been navigating or trying to survive it, that when I saw you were coming out with this book, I was so happy to know that I could talk with you again. Because when I was doing that podcast, I was deeply interested in fat phobia and how we navigate living in this culture in our bodies. And when you told me you were writing a book about fat phobia, I thought, that's a book I want to read. You know, I had been thinking of writing a book myself around this topic, but then I realized in talking with you, I don't want to write it. I want to read it. And so now I want to read your book. And so it is my deep honor to have you here. And I would love you to just begin our conversation by talking a little bit about your newest book, Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia, and what it's about.
Well, I'd love to. And thank you so much for your kind words. I've loved our conversations, and I love that we get to have this one too. So I wrote two books on misogyny. The first was called Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. And the second is called Entitled, How Male Privilege Hurts Women. And I found when I wrote those two books, people would often ask me, well, how did you get interested in the topic of misogyny? It doesn't sound very fun, as my 4-year-old would say. It's kind of a grim, dark topic. So what were the experiences that led you to want to explore it in two books? And the truth was that I couldn't answer that question without also telling a story about fat phobia, because back in Australia, I was one of three girls who joined an all-boys school the year it integrated in my penultimate year of high school when I was 16. And it was a very misogynistic environment, being very male-dominated. I was very much perceived as really stepping on boys' toes and being on male-dominated turf in ways that were controversial. But the way that misogyny was often manifesting itself in that very, very misogynistic, male-dominated environment was directing fat phobia at me as a then chubby teen. That was the way that misogyny raised its ugly head, and it was how I came to be really self-conscious about my then chubby and later genuinely fat body as a young woman.
Mm-hmm. And throughout the book, I'm so curious about your approach to writing these books, because they are dense with information and they also have your reflection. And in this book, you have incorporated research and media, and you also have your own story, which we're definitely going to dig into. So I'm curious, how, with having a child at home, having a teaching job, how do you manage and organize all this material? What is your work process like?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually found it was quite interesting, the process of writing this book, because it was very different than my process with other books. With the other two, I would really have all day, and to some extent, at least during sabbaticals or summer research time, I would often have every day to work on my writing, to work on my books, to look up studies. Whereas here, having a young child at home, as you say, it was a really much more constrained process. So both my husband and I are teachers at Cornell. He's a lecturer, I'm a professor. And we were both, during the pandemic, we didn't have any outside childcare help. So we were really in the thick of it with our young daughter, who was born just a few months before the pandemic hit. And what I would do, and I know this is a bit of a cliche, but I actually found myself spending the 2 or 3 hours a day that she spent napping just writing really furiously. So for those 2 or 3 hours, I did nothing else. I had 2 or 3 hours a day very reliably where I would just sit beside her on the couch while she napped in her snuggle nest or whatever it was, these rather hideous names they have for baby here. And because I had to be really still so I wouldn't wake her up, I would just turn on the noise machine, have my laptop, be typing or sometimes writing on paper. And it was, 2 or 3 hours of really devoted work time, writing time every day, instead of having a whole 8-hour, 10-hour work day where I could distribute that energy. But I actually found it worked really well. And then I would spend parts of the rest of the day looking up research, looking up studies, reading other writers, but that writing time was really concentrated for almost the first time in my life.
Oh, yeah. And maybe there was a lot of pressure, but also a really good concentrated time frame where you knew this was when you really need to bring your A game. And then if you can do that and take advantage of the time, you're kind of off the hook for the heavy duty writing for the rest of the day.
Exactly. It was like, go. She falls asleep. Go. Like, this is the only time I'm going to have available today until sometime late at night when I'm usually too tired to do my best writing. Yeah, that would be the time I really had to get into it. And so it felt like a very specific and precious, but also somewhat pressurized way to write a book.
Is it ever hard for you when compiling your research, looking up data, poring over studies and things like that, to get in the weeds there instead of writing the material that it has to bolster that?
Yes, definitely.
Because I know for me, it's so fun sometimes to kind of travel down that maze and figure out where the data is. But I don't know, because I've never written a braided memoir or a braided type of book like this where, and for the purposes of this podcast, I'll call it braided because there are memoirists who like to incorporate research, memoiristic aspects and media and all that in their books. So how did you even organize it? How do you keep it sort of categorized and not lose all the material you have to incorporate.
Yeah, for me, it was often about how do I divide up all of this material where I had been thinking about the topic of fat phobia more or less from the time that I was teased and bullied in high school. And then I encountered fat activism on the internet just a few years later when I was in college with writers like Kate Harding and Leslie Kinzel and Marion Kirby. These were just huge influences on me in the early 2000s. So I had a lot of a sense of what research needed to go into the book or where to look for relevant research. But then it was a matter of disentangling these threads that I began to think of fat phobia as kind of this tangled rope, which my job as a writer was to disentangle various threads of it and use those as the basis for chapters. So lots of material did end up moving around quite a bit, but that gave me, if you like, a blueprint for what would logically belong in the chapter about the moral aspects of fat phobia, the way that fat people are blamed morally for the size of our bodies in a way that I argue is wrongheaded. It gave me a sense of where the material on intellectual fat phobia would belong, where fat people are often held to be not intellectual authority figures or even intellectually competent. And the material on sexual fat phobia was actually the first part of the book that I wrote because it was what got me into the project originally. And then, of course, there's a very, for me, fun and collaborative editorial process where my wonderful co-editors Amanda Cook and Katie Barry at Crown then pushed me to write a chapter on the complex relationship between weight and health, which I had been reluctant to tackle because I think, in a way, it doesn't matter because even if fat people are unhealthy, we still deserve humane, compassionate healthcare and to be treated decently. But as they pointed out, many people do have myths in their mind about this being a much simpler relationship than is actually the case. So, of course, I wanted to do justice to that concern readers had. So I ended up adding a chapter at the advice of my wonderful editorial team. So that gave me a way to divide up all this rich material where it was all kind of buzzing in my head for a long time, particularly in the lead up to writing the book. And then it was a matter of slotting it into these different analytic categories of the kind of fat phobia it belonged to, along with then later chapters on diet culture and hunger and my concept of bodily reflexivity, which is my alternative to body positivity and neutrality, that is based in the idea that your body is for you. So yeah, that was kind of how I ended up approaching that really delicate question as a writer of how to distribute material.
And then when it comes to the memoir aspects of writing the book, how was that for you? How did you calibrate that? Did you lean naturally into sharing your personal experience? Did you need prodding to do that? Did you have to pare it back? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it certainly felt like a vulnerable exercise because I've really never written personally before. In fact, readers of my first two books would often say, "It's interesting, you must have experienced misogyny as a woman in philosophy, but you seem to have written yourself out." And I honestly never was there to begin with. I do feel like the misogyny I've encountered in my life, it's, well, I've certainly had experiences of it. It hasn't been particularly severe or drastic. And really that early experience of misogyny in high school was the most dramatic. And I simply couldn't write about it meaningfully without discussing the fat phobia, the misogynistic and sexual fat phobia directed at my body. So it did feel really vulnerable to write about that for the first time in my writing career, which has spanned, I guess, now 10-ish years of writing for a public audience, as well as earlier years of more academic writing. But it also felt really cathartic, honestly, to be able to share my story in a way that felt like hopefully an exercise in solidarity and lifting my head out of shame. I was thinking a lot about the characteristic posture of shame and the way it kind of bows our head and we lower our eyes and we sever the sight lines between oneself and the other. And writing in a way that was an attempt to meet the reader's gaze and say, "This is my story, how about you? What has your experience been?" Implicitly inviting the reader to reflect upon their body journeys, that felt like a step forward in terms of being a person in the world, existing in a body and coming to terms with it.
Mm. Did you know then early on that you were definitely going to include this intimate reflection?
Yeah, I did. I think the very first piece that we connected about that I wrote for the New York Times, mm-hmm. which was about the immorality of diet culture. I think it was called Diet Culture is Unhealthy, It's Also Immoral, if I'm recalling correctly what they called it eventually. Mm-hmm. Obviously, writers don't get to pick their titles, so it's a funny exercise in recalling it. But I wanted to depart from that piece. And I remember writing that piece during one of my daughter's earlier naps when she was napping consistently as an infant, but not still a newborn, and just kind of pouring a lot of my story onto the page and feeling like, oh, this is new. This is surprising. This is a different turn for me. So that intimacy was there from the beginning, actually. Mm-hmm. And it felt like it was partly a reflection of that period in early motherhood where you question a lot of what you have held close to your chest. And you do wonder, well, if I'm going through my life holding on to this shame, holding on to this bodily dissatisfaction, and not really working on turning my politics, my longstanding politics around fatness into a personal ethos, what will my child be exposed to? So that was why I wanted to be more open, more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was hoping you would read from the introduction, that the section we talked about, introduction, fighting weight, until that sentence I sent you.
I'd love to. I should have been thrilled. My first book, which I wrote as an academic text, expecting an audience of just dozens, had been sold in paperback to a major UK publisher. A study of misogyny, down girl canvas strangulation, sexual harassment, sexual assault, and rape culture. I wanted to get the word out, to talk about these issues that matter to me more than almost anything. But when my editor suggested an all-expenses-paid publicity tour of London, with bookstore readings and television appearances, I flinched from the prospect. I felt too fat to be a feminist in public. I felt too big to speak out about the down girl moves that teach girls and women to be small, meek, and quiet. And as acutely aware as I was of the irony, it wasn't enough to shift my thinking in the moment. The Australian author Helen Garner once remarked that she felt the need to get down to her quote-unquote fighting weight before embarking on a publicity tour. I cursed myself for not doing that, and in fact being at my heaviest. I clocked in then, in early 2019, at a weight that made me severely obese, according to the BMI chart my doctor pointed to, frowning. My book had first come out late in 2017, the very week that Tarana Burke's Me Too movement was popularized by celebrities. And so, much to my surprise, I found myself talking to journalists about misogyny almost daily. But I would not allow camera crews to come to my home or office. I hid my body from the public eye by only ever appearing on camera via Skype, so I could control the angle. I had a handful of carefully curated headshots from when I was thinner, though I have never been thin in my adult life, that I used for every interview. I would agree to give interviews only when they promised to use one of them, rather than sending their own photographer. Sometimes this was a battle. When I gave talks, I asked audience members not to take any photos. When people occasionally took them anyway and posted them on social media, I begged them to take them down. I explained in a partial truth that I was subject to a lot of misogynistic trolling, and that new photos of me that appeared online would attract mockery and vitriol. And indeed, I'd been called a bitch and worse too many times to mention. Dumb cunt writing dumb things was one of the first tweets I saw after publishing my first New York Times piece. And subject to anti-Semitic slurs, too. Your people will burn in ovens now, someone DM'd me the night Trump was elected. Rape threats are not uncommon in my little corner of the internet. But there was one reaction I really dreaded. Being called fat. which I was. I was fat, but I couldn't hear it, not even in my own voice, without wanting to disappear myself. I knew that would be all it took to silence me. You might expect that as a lifelong feminist, not to mention the author of now two books on misogyny, I would be one of the last people to be suckered into policing my own body and trying to force it into a size and shape more acceptable to the patriarchy. You'd be wrong about that, sadly. Since my early 20s, I have been on every fad diet. I have tried every weight loss pill. And I have, to be candid, starved myself, even not so long ago. I can also tell you what I weighed on any significant occasion from the age of 16 onward. I can tell you precisely what I weighed on my wedding day, the day I defended my PhD dissertation, and the day I became a professor, as well as the day I gave birth to my daughter. Too much, too much, too much, and much too much to my own mind then. I even know what I weighed on the day I arrived in Boston, fresh off the plane from my hometown of Melbourne, Australia, to begin graduate school in philosophy nearly 20 years ago. I had packed my scales with all of my worldly possessions in one of two overflowing suitcases. They were among the first things I unpacked, second only to my toothbrush. In coming of age and size, in a fatphobic society, I learned to avoid certain key opportunities, risks, and pleasures. I have been swimming just once since the age of 16. I wore leggings and an oversized t-shirt. I haven't been dancing since I was 20. And nobody, save my husband and doctors, has seen the dimpled stretch marks backs of my knees over the same time period. My wardrobe is approximately 80% leggings. So, fat phobia has made me miss out on a lot in life. It has made me undertake a careful social calculus whereby the risk of being judged, scorned, and discredited for my fat body has often not been worth the potential benefits of putting myself out there. And so I have shrunk from public scrutiny.
Thank you so much. Sadly, I think that many, many women can relate to this. And you talk later on about the health at every size movement, and you talk about this intuitive eating. I was really struck by your vulnerability in this section. And I was wondering, how far did you or did you have to push yourself to write this particular material?
Yeah, it was really pushing myself. And I think it was two factors that I had to work through. One was the body shame itself, because I had to talk pretty candidly about being not just someone who considered myself fat, but being genuinely a fat person whose BMI was over 40 at one point. And I should add, I was a healthy and happy fat person who was pretty active and who had great blood work and all the rest of it. Not that one should have to defend one's health status to be valid, but it is interesting that I think my body was actually pretty happy at that high weight. A weight that's higher than I am now by a considerable margin, and where I actually think my health has been negatively affected by having shrunk myself down to a smaller size, which I suspect is very much temporary for my body. So I had to work through my body shame, but I also had to work through my shame at my body shame. And this fact that I have long had, I think, a pretty solid politics around fat phobia and been fully on board with it being a social justice issue that way too many liberals and leftists and progressives like me are complacent about. And yet I had been, I came to think, complicit in diet culture, complicit in this project that I kept undertaking, and which increasingly was a failed project, but the project of trying to make myself conform in this bodily respect that felt so compulsory, even as I tried to be an outspoken feminist who was leaving other social norms completely behind in my life. So the shame at my shame was also something that really dogged me in writing about this.
Where are you on that now?
I think it was interesting. When I first started writing the book, I was really ashamed of my shame, and I was inclined to, even as I just described it now, count myself as someone who had been doing the wrong thing, being complicit in diet culture, and complicit in fat phobia, because diet culture tells us that the means to the end of a thinner body, this wonderful ideal of a thin body, is via dieting. And so ultimately the real villain here is fat phobia, not diet culture. But I became more self-compassionate in the process of writing the book, actually. I came to think that really, what else would you expect in a society that demands certain aesthetic performances from especially women as well as girls, and really exacts a hefty penalty in as much as we let our bodies be how they naturally are, which is diverse in size and shape, as well as in any number of other characteristics like skin tone and disability and being trans or queer and so on. Mm-hmm. So that bodily diversity piece of it was a belief that I found really difficult to incorporate when it came to fatness into my personal practice, and I began to forgive myself for finding it as hard as I have.
Mm-hmm. It's like, I feel like it's not wrong to say it's almost the last frontier if we can make peace with our bodies or understand that, because it's sort of like this target of a certain body type or a weight or whatever it is that we have in mind is like, it's always going to be out of reach. Going to be, because it's not about that. And, you know, it is about that. It is about the way we look, but it's also not about the way we look. And what you write about fat phobia is that, among many things that you write, but I pulled this, is that you came to understand that what you hated was less your body than the way it made you vulnerable to being put down and ridiculed and belittled. And you said, you write, I began to hear and use the word fat not as an insult, but as a neutral description of some bodies. And that's what you do throughout the book. And that fat phobia is a form of structural oppression. Had you decided that as you wrote the book? Did you discover that? Were you consuming material that already told you that, or did you kind of have to invent it for yourself?
I very much believed it for a long time, thanks to the brilliant fat activist work that I encountered some 25 years ago. And I think it's tricky, right? When you said it is and it isn't about the fat body, I think that's exactly right. On the one hand, it's about keeping women, especially, and I think people really of any gender, and certainly this cuts across lots of different lines in terms of gender and race and socioeconomic class and whatnot. But it's about keeping us on a perpetual treadmill, in part. Mm-hmm. Our bodies are never quite good enough. They're never quite conforming enough. They're never quite straight enough or cis enough or thin enough or smooth enough or young enough or non-disabled
it's
enough.
It's anything, right. Yeah. And then even if your body was whatever enough, I feel like then the next moving target would be, do you have the right material to dress your body? Do you have the right products? Do you have the right colors? Like all that stuff.
Totally. I mean, the youth's obsession with skincare is, on the one hand, nothing new. I was a big body shop aficionado back in the day, but it also does point to the fact that we're being exploited for capitalist profits to try to wring out of us, via our sense of bodily dissatisfaction, money and time mm-hmm. and bandwidth and creativity and all the rest of it. So it isn't about the fat body, but it also is, in the sense that people who are larger face genuine material and systemic barriers to participation in the world in ways that I think are very much a form of systemic oppression, and that really intersect with every other major form of oppression that many liberals and leftists are more up in arms about, and rightly so. But I really don't think we can address any form of oppression that we allege to care about, like racism, like misogyny, like classism, ableism, transphobia, and so on, without also addressing fat phobia. Because as scholars like Sabrina Strings and Deshaun Harrison have argued, anti-fatness is a form of anti-blackness, and it is rooted in anti-black bias.
Which is exactly what I wanted to talk about. You got to the heart of that in the book about the racism associated with fat phobia. So I was hoping you could share some background on the perception of black bodies historically, and slavery, thinness, and class, and what that has meant here in the West.
Absolutely. So here I'm drawing on this brilliant work of, here initially I'll talk about Strings's scholarship. So she's a UCLA sociologist. And what she has shown really powerfully is that fat phobia is a pretty recent form of bias. So historically, It's not that there were no elements of fat phobia in the discourse ever, but the fat body was treated often as a good thing, or it was at least a source of ambivalence. And oftentimes fatness was seen as a sign of wealth and luxury and abundance and delicious amplitude or heft, rather than something that was abhorred. And that was maintained up until around the mid-18th century, when an association between fatness and blackness began to be drawn by white racist colonists and pseudoscientists who theorized on the basis of their armchair ideas that black bodies were fatter and used this as a pretext to justify the transatlantic slave trade that was burgeoning in such brutal and ever-increasing numbers. So I want to be very clear about how this went. It wasn't that fatness was derogated and then associated with blackness. It went the other way. Fatness was associated with blackness, and then the fat body came to be derogated shortly thereafter as a way to justify the booming transatlantic slave trade and to allege that fat black bodies were quote-unquote primitive and depraved, even evil, all of these disgustingly, abhorrently racist ideas, the legacy of which we're still dealing with today. So Deshaun Harrison, in particular, here I draw upon their brilliant work showing that black men who have been murdered by racist white cops, so state executions, such as in the case of Darren Wilson murdering Michael Brown in Ferguson and Daniel Pantaleo murdering Eric Garner in Staten Island, these were both not just black men, but large black men. In the case of Eric Garner, very large black men who were taken down partly on the pretext that they were quote unquote beastly and posed a threat to these, again, deeply racist white cops. So what Harrison shows is that the black body is both perceived, particularly in its mask or masculine form, as too imposing, too threatening when fat, and also ironically is too vulnerable, because when Pantaleo murdered Eric Garner by strangling him via the chokehold that took his life, tragically, Garner was held to be quote-unquote morbidly obese and a ticking time bomb in defenses of this police officer's murder. So the idea was he would have died anyway because he happened to be a fat black man. And as Harrison says, like, whatever his health status, the one thing he was not before this encounter was dead. So, yeah, it is a really shocking indictment that I think we should be very cognizant of the way that fat black and arguably, you know, this at least affects fat mask people in distinctive ways, although I think fat black women are also treated abhorrently. But this can be literally fatal for fat black mask bodies who are targeted in these ways.
Thank you for sharing that. And I know there's even more. It's a fascinating chapter, and it illuminated so much for me, and it made a lot of sense, because for so long I wondered, but why do we have this idea about fat in this country? And what you wrote answered that question for me, because I was looking for the kernel, you know, where did this start? And so I really understood that a lot better. And then it's got its tentacles in all of us, even if we're not conscious of where it began.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Renate. That means a lot to me. And yeah, I just owe all of this, I think, to me, compelling historical explanation to Strings and Harrison, who brought this out for me in ways that were quite new. So this was material I had not encountered before, and Strings's book came out in 2019, and I think really rocked the field of fat studies and the sociological and philosophical communities interested in fatness by offering this explanation of anti-fatness that was so persuasive and so damning.
And we'll definitely, I'll link to their work in the show notes as well to give them the credit they deserve. And I appreciate that you have clarified that too. So what are some of the more insidious and dangerous physical and psychosocial consequences of fat phobia on our bodies? I know you know this very well, but for those who have not yet read your book, I was hoping you could just share a few.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that because some of the rhetoric around weight and health is so fraught, it's really worth reflecting on the fact that one of the major drivers for a lot of the bad outcomes for very fat bodies is weight stigma. So when a patient who is fat, especially a patient who's very fat, goes to see the doctor, and I just want to clarify again that when I use the word fat, I'm doing so in a spirit of this being not a bad word, not a shameful word, but I use it merely as a neutral description of some bodies, a way that is consistent with attempts to reclaim words like queer and so on. And I totally understand if some people aren't comfortable with it and prefer terms like larger, so we can use that too. But I myself now identify as fat, albeit a small fat person. Fat activists have distinguished between small fat, mid-fat, and large fat people, just by way of a little background to distinguish various degrees of privilege here. Mm-hmm. So when a very fat person does go to see a doctor, oftentimes physicians will make pernicious assumptions that this person is lazy, non-compliant, lacks willpower, has done this to themselves, despite ample evidence that fatness is by and large unchosen. A lot of it is due to genetic factors. It can also have to do with other unchosen factors like trauma, the food environment, common illnesses, common medications, and the stress on the body caused by dieting and weight cycling. So what happens when people go on diets is they typically lose a moderate amount of weight during the initial phase, but then the weight comes back nearly inexorably. And mm-hmm. for many people between 1/3 and 2/3, people will actually end up heavier than they started. So someone who is very fat has often been on umpteen diets, mm-hmm. like I have, and has constantly been on this cycle of losing and then regaining weight. And that turns out to have these deleterious health effects on the body. So you go in, you have been on any number of diets, the weight has come back, maybe even driving you well over your initial set point, and your weight isn't something that you have just chosen to be at in the majority of cases. But of course, a doctor's go-to suggestion is often based purely on your appearance and is just go lose weight rather than investigating the real cause of people's symptoms. So I have numerous cases in the book where people had terrible, insidious forms of cancer that were ravaging their body, but were just told to go lose weight because they present as a fat patient. In addition to that bias on the part of physicians that is driving those negative outcomes, it is tremendously stressful to go through in physician encounters which are so devoid of empathy and concern and connection. So studies show that physicians, as well as commonly dismissing patients on the basis of their body mass, also say that for fat patients, the fat patient is more likely to annoy them, that they're less inclined to help fat patients, and that they regard fat patients as a waste of their time. So I want to be very clear, this isn't just implicit bias, this is explicit bias on the part of many physicians, with the result that as, in particular, a woman's body mass increases, in direct proportion to that, she will tend to start avoiding healthcare altogether. And so, obviously, again, that has pretty terrible effects on the human body, not getting adequate healthcare, not getting adequate screenings, preventative care, being subject to the stress of stigma throughout society, but also in encounters which should be looking after you and looking out for your health in particular. And the results of that are something that we see upon autopsy is people who had been classified as quote-unquote obese, which is a word I don't love, but let's use it as a reference point, they are some 1.65 times more likely to have serious undiagnosed medical conditions like endocarditis, a heart condition, or lung carcinoma upon autopsy. So in other words, people are not having serious and for the most part, non-weight related conditions diagnosed in their lifetime in ways that could have been life-saving.
Mm-hmm. And that's not even counting, this is all on the medical side, that's not even taking into consideration how people feel on airplanes, in seating that may not accommodate them, in social settings, etc.
And we see this directly in studies, the ill effects of internalized fat phobia on the body. So part of it is just the sheer fat phobia, not internalized, but external, in the sense that people are just not able to fit in the space designated for them in society. But what we saw in one really interesting study, and admittedly it is just one study, but people who also had high internalized weight stigma were 3 times more likely then to have metabolic syndrome, which is this cluster of risk factors, including things like high blood pressure and high blood glucose and high cholesterol. And that compared with low internalized weight stigma participants who were matched for things like age and gender and race, who had much better health outcomes. Mm. So it's almost like we imbibe this stress and this weight stigma, and the more we do so, which is entirely understandable in a fat phobic society, the harder it is on the body, and the more we see this actually having the deleterious health effects that, ironically, people are yelling at us, oh, you're fat, you're so unhealthy, which the true picture is a lot more complicated than that. But that very stigma is actually driving health ill effects in a direct way.
Yes, and when you were talking about diets a moment ago, I had pulled this quote. Just a section of it is that the lead researcher in a study at UCLA named Tracy Mann said that in their findings, for people who are on diets, that you can initially lose 5 to 10% of your weight on any number of diets, but then the weight comes back. And we found that the majority of people regained all the weight plus more. Only a small minority of participants showed sustained weight loss, and the majority showed complete weight regain. So I feel like, you know, a lot of people who've been on diets, we learn this, we know this, it's kind of understood. That's why the diet industry is always booming and these fads continue to, you know, populate. But what do you think? Why do smart, experienced, oftentimes compassionate people keep going on diets? Like, why do we keep doing that, even though we know?
Especially since the research is so clear on this point. So Tracy Mann, Janet Tamayama, these brilliant researchers, they're not doing 1 or 2 studies. They're doing meta-analyses of really every single major diet study to date that is longitudinal and that lasted 4 to 5 years. So they're really comprehensively evaluating all of the possible outcomes. And while there's certainly the occasional exception to the rule, it is very clear that the rule is people initially lose some weight on diets, for the most part, not everyone does, but people will initially lose perhaps between 5 and 10% of their starting weight, but the weight comes back almost inevitably for the vast majority of people, and most people will end up heavier than they started. So dieting is actually a really strong predictor of weight regain and arguably overshooting your body's natural set point, which is a somewhat controversial idea, but I think has some validity to it. Our bodies just have a weight that varies wildly, but is different for different people and might differ over the lifetime too, but where our bodies are kind of actively happy and comfortable in our particular body weight that, again, might be higher or lower for different body types, and just people come in different shapes and sizes. But in terms of why we keep doing this to ourselves, I think, and I argue in the book, it's not too strong to say that we are gaslit. There is this rhetoric around dieting that the next diet will be different and you're not really hungry, you're thirsty and you're an emotional overeater. And even if it's in fact you're at a weight where you might be classified as obese, many people who are in the higher weight categories assume that they have to lose weight for their health. But if you're in the moderately obese category with a BMI between 30 and 35, it's not even true that you have an elevated risk in terms of all-cause mortality based on major epidemiological studies. But there is this gaslighting, oh, you have to lose weight, you'll be so much healthier, you'll be so much happier. And all of this rhetoric kind of extends to how we think about food and our intake, and, oh, we're so disgusting for eating this, oh, this delicious fatty food is actually gross and horrible and makes our bodies feel terrible, and this dry rice cake is actually so satisfying, and actually what my body wanted was salad, where no, usually our bodies want a range of different foods on different occasions, and that's perfectly normal and healthy. So yeah, does that make sense? There's this insidious set of discourses that I think have this gaslighting effect of making us feel crazy, but even more than that, guilty and ashamed for just having the bodies we have and having the normal human healthy appetites that we have for food and pleasure, and food is part of that.
Yes, and there was that excerpt I was talking about possibly having you read, but I think for the interest of time, I would love to just get to the actual punchline, which is, as human beings, I think we also don't quite trust pleasure. That's in chapter 4, Demoralizing Fatness. I was wondering if you can speak to that a little bit about our not trusting pleasure.
Yeah, totally. I think there is this almost Puritan sense that if something feels really good for the body, then it must be bad for it, or that we must be sinful for indulging. And I think even if many of us in contemporary life disavow those sorts of beliefs and see them as signs of older religious traditions or arcane ones that don't really reflect our contemporary practices, we do have these notions like guilty pleasure, or this almost tastes too good, or I should be quote unquote good today in terms of how I approach what I eat, where what a lot of experienced dietitians and nutritionists tell me is what is actually driving a lot of food obsession and what people do understandably worry about, which is getting too kind of drawn to the pleasures of the flesh in ways that mean that they won't be able to pursue other parts of their lives that are important. Those restrictive behaviors are what are driving that food obsession and fixation. Mm-hmm. So I've actually found this to be very true in my own life. When I take the pressure off and I eat intuitively and I eat what sounds good to me in a way that isn't punitive and that does trust pleasure, I find that I am not obsessed with food at all and enjoy it and get a lot of pleasure out of it on a daily basis, but also don't agonize over it at all.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about what advice would you give to writers contemplating sharing parts of their lives that they worry they'll be judged for, like the very intimate details and parts of the shame about the shame that you share in your book. How would you help fortify a writer who wasn't sure they could do it?
Yeah, well, I would say first of all that you shouldn't do it if you're not ready. Like, you are never obligated to share your story, and that doing so is, I think, a real act of generosity. So this is how I would frame it. When you tell your story and the bits of it that are the hardest, it is a way of, I think, finding solidarity with other readers who've been there too, and to other writers who will go on to write about these themes in a way that is less self-conscious, less ashamed, and freer, really exploring these ideas because you've been there and done a similar thing, been through a similar exercise in vulnerability. So yeah, I would reframe it as an act of generosity, a way of saying, this is my story, how about you? Like, is this something you can relate to? And many, many times the answer will be yes for many people. And my strong suspicion is when this is done in a spirit of honesty and authenticity and that generosity, for every person who is judgmental or shames you or punishes you for revealing what you've revealed, there will be many more people who benefit from that openness and that wisdom and that shared sense of bodily and intellectual vulnerability that you can feel on the page.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I very much agree. Do you think that the you of 10 years ago, maybe, or maybe even 6 years ago, would be surprised that you had written such an intimate book?
Yeah, totally shocked. I never would have seen this coming. But I mean, that being said, I've been interested in this my whole life. Like, every bit of fat activists or even just fat writers talking openly about their bodies, I have consumed avidly. So in some ways it's very unsurprising, but in other ways the willingness to actually write about it myself came as a total surprise to me. And yeah, it was connected with wanting to set a different kind of example for my daughter of not being mired in the sort of body shame I didn't want her to bear witness to. So it's a bit of a cliche that motherhood changed me in this way. And I'm always suspicious of narratives of transformation around parenthood, especially motherhood. But I think on this score, it did change me in a pretty fundamental way of making me capable of speaking out about something I've long kept inside and pretty buried.
Are there books you'd like to recommend listeners turn to? I can put those in the show notes too.
Yeah, I'd love that. So I have mentioned already two favorites in this vicinity that I drew on a lot for the book, Sabrina Strings's Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia, and also Deshaun Harrison's Belly of the Beast, Anti-Fatness as Anti-Blackness, or I think it's The Politics of Anti-Fatness as Anti-Blackness is the full subtitle. I also really love and felt ripped open by Roxane Gay's memoir Hunger, that is such a brilliant read on this topic. And she is one of the best writers out there, simpliciter, but also one of the best memoirists of having a very fat body and what that is like. I recommend Tressie McMillan Cottom's brilliant essay collection Thick, that is a set of themes to, in a way, thick and entangled to do justice to neatly, but I would characterize her as just one of the most brilliant Black feminist sociologists working today in a way that combines elements of personal narrative, a label which she is, by the way, interestingly ambivalent about, with elements of high theory, a deep theory of the social. And you can see I'm very excited to do this. Aubrey Gordon's books, What We Don't Talk About When We Talk About Fat, and You Just Need to Lose Weight, and 19 Other Myths About Fat People, both brilliant books. And finally, I want to recommend my friend Virginia Soul Smith's book, Fat Talk, Parenting in the Age of Diet Culture, which is a real deep dive into the tricky parenting questions and practices that arise around feeding your kid, watching your kid grow, thinking about everything from team sports for different sizes of children to very practical questions about how to navigate children's birthday parties with in a way that is embracing of the fact that there may be fat kids in your child's class, or your child may be the fat kid and everyone deserves to be included. So do we need to think about the weight limit on the bouncy house, for example, is a example I recently encountered in my own life, where you might have to think critically about the sorts of size limits there are in the world that can make the place less welcoming for larger children in ways many of us don't want, but have to think about a bit critically in order to do better on.
Thank you so much for those. Excited to share those. And I guess lastly, where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, so I am sort of still on Twitter, or X, as I refuse to call it, in a very perfunctory way. So I'm Kate_man on there, and probably will stick around until the grim death. I am katemann.substack.com, where I write a newsletter called More to Hate. That is probably the best place to find my musings on fat phobia and misogyny and their intersection and more. And you can also follow me on Instagram, where I have a very modest presence, but I am Kate_man on Instagram too. So yeah, I'd love to connect with listeners and readers.
Great. Thank you so much. Kate, I could talk to you forever. Same. I love talking with you, and I'm so happy we had this chance, and I congratulations on this third book, and thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you so much, Renit. It was an absolute pleasure and a privilege. And yeah, I'm just so glad to be connected.
Thank you for tuning in to Let's Talk Memoir. For more about this episode and my guest, please visit the link in the show notes or on Instagram at Ronit Plank. That's RONITPLANK. You can also follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok. If you liked this episode of Let's Talk Memoir, please go ahead and share it with your friends and subscribe. And if you have 2 more seconds, you can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, which really does help other people find the show. Thank you so much for being here.